This podcast is a production of Crosspoint Church. Visit us online at crosspointwithane.org.
So last Sunday we went through and started a series and started with the person of Esau, and we talked about some things that were really important, and then we had these technical difficulties and it didn't allow us to record what we experienced Sunday. But we got lots of requests from people that wanted to give it to a friend or hear it again, and so what we decided to do is we just take some time and go through it again and make sure we record it. So as you listen to this, it's not what the Sunday morning experience was, but it's the same content, and we wanted to make sure that we provided that for you. We begin a new series that as we said, we're very excited about, designed to challenge us and help us and rattle us in all the right ways. Over the next few weeks, we want to do some exploring. We want to look at a few biblical people that maybe you've heard of, and if you've ever heard of them, as soon as you hear their name, you think, hey, that's one of them. That's one of the villains. That's one of those people that they had to be in the story so that the hero could look more heroic. They could be shown to be more good. People like Esau, people like Pontius Pilate, people like Cain, Ananias and Sapphira. But our contention for the next few Sundays is that their story serves more than to balance the good guys, to be a counterbalance so good guys can look more good. What we want to do is explore how their story is our story sometimes, how them are us, how the thing that the Bible highlights and even holds against them sometimes that may be a highlight that God is using to work out something in us. So the idea is for the next four Sundays, this would be very challenging. It'd be that it'd be uncomfortable, frankly. That it would be something that we would allow God to use to shape us, even if it's difficult, even if it comes through pain and hardship, that we'd let God use it to shape us into the people that we really are. We're going to start in Genesis 25, in the 27th chapter of Genesis 25. I'm going to give a brief background of the text. In Genesis 25, by the time we get to this point in the Bible, God has made a promise to a man named Abraham. And he's told Abraham that through his lineage, that God's people would come to be the light of the world. They would be called to live out these ways of God so that the whole world could see it. And Jews, to this day, they refer to God, as the scriptures do, as the God of the patriarchs, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of that family. The God of the sacred lineage that would one day produce the Messiah. And so when we come to this text at this point in history, we're being told about Jacob. But our time is going to be spent discussing his older twin brother, Esau. And so we start in verse 27. The boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was a quiet man staying among the tents. So right away we can see that Esau liked to play outside while Jacob played video games. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau came in from the open country, famished. And he said to Jacob, "Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished." That's why he was also called Edom. Now you need to understand here that Esau, when he's born, he's covered with red hair. He's like covered from head to toe. He looks like a red goat. And so his name kind of has that connotation to it, that he's red. And so he comes in and he sees this red stuff when he's hungry. And in the original Hebrew, it's an ecstatic phrase. Because he even repeats himself. Esau says, "Quick, give me some of that red stuff, that red stuff." The actual Hebrew is the ha-edam, ha-edam. The red. "Quick, give me some of that." He's very enthusiastically asking for a bowl of this special red stuff. Jacob replied, "First, sell me your birthright." "Look, I'm about to die," Esau said. "What good is the birthright to me?" Now, from here it gets interesting because Jacob says, "Swear to me first." And so he, Esau, swore an oath to Jacob, selling his birthright to Jacob. Now for us, in the modern Western mind, we get to the part about birthrights and we're like, well, who cares? You know, that's completely outdated. What's that? But to the first Jews who heard this story, and to many Eastern minds today, this is a very offensive, scandalous story. See, a birthright is your heritage. God swore to Abraham that the Jewish lineage would be called to be the light of the world. The birthright was, it was your name. It's your inheritance. It's your destiny. It's your place in the sacred family that will bring the Messiah, the hope of the world. It's who you are. It's who your children will be. It's who their children will be. It's the family that lives around you because you're a nomadic communal dweller, and so it's your place in your culture. The birthright's not just your destiny either. It gives you twice as much inheritance from your father as all the other kids. The firstborn son gets the birthright, and that means a double share, a double portion of the inheritance. Your birthright, it's like everything. And Esau is like, eh, whatever. I mean, this story is unbelievably scandalous to the first readers. Everything he was meant to be, and he says, well, who cares about that? I'm hungry. Everything God had given this family to carry on, Esau's responsibility to take his place in this sacred lineage, to be the hope and the promise of the world. And he says, why in the world would I care about that? I'm starving. I mean, the only thing I can think to compare this to is your son coming home and saying, Dad, I got really hungry for breakfast this morning, and so I had to make this little deal, which required me to legally change my last name. I liquidated the trust fund that you built for me, and I joined the Taliban. But I'm full, so thank you. I mean, unbelievably heartbreaking impulse that Esau makes. Sold his destiny, sold who he was for this temporary craving for the red stuff. Enthusiastically gave it all away for a temporary craving. Now, here's the wrong way to come out on this passage. If Esau loved God and took his faith seriously, he would not have desires. I mean, that'd be the wrong thing to take away from this. To just look at it and say, well, it's because desire is bad. And Esau let himself desire, and therefore he got himself into this mess. That's the wrong way to look at that. But many of us in this room, we come from a religious background or a tradition, or we're even aware that religion has this reputation that says strong desire is bad. Desire has to be suppressed. In fact, it has to be eliminated. Many religions outside of Christianity, their core tenets say that human desire is the main problem in the world. If you can get rid of desire, you'll be free. You'll have peace. My goal is not to knock other religions, but what I want to submit is that it's impossible to get rid of desire and be a healthy human being. We're made with certain healthy appetites. We're made that way. I mean, if you want to get a good idea of what God is like, if you're trying to shake this idea that God is this old man in the sky, consider the fact that God gave you taste buds. Your food was designed to be more than just fuel. It could be just stuff that you put in and you get energy, but instead, it's like he wanted you almost to be entertained by it. You can almost picture God giving Adam in the garden the first bite of food and saying, do you like it? What do you think? Do you like it? It's not just fuel. Take it farther. God made reproduction. Human reproduction is this delightful experience. So it's more than this mechanical process. It's almost like God not only wants us to enjoy life, but the things that sustain life, those are enjoyable as well. Desire is a good thing in its context. Here's the problem. The whole world is out of context. Nothing is as it should be. Everything is out of context. It's like everybody's walking around to some degree just not feeling right, just out of balance, and just desperately uncomfortable. To some degree, uncomfortable. It may come and go, but people are uncomfortable. We look around and we know that people are broken because we live in a world that's fallen under this cloud of sin. Sin not just in immorality, sin just as this cloud that hangs over with evil and brokenness and things just not being the way they should be. We live in a world where people are wounded and wound each other. They're aching, desperate to find their identity. Somebody tell me who I am. Let me invent who I am. People walking around with regret and pain and confusion. It's like everybody's walking around with that ache that comes from knowing deep down in your soul that you've been kicked out of Eden or out of context. And so the culture that we live in, it seems to pride itself on offering superficial relief for these aches and cravings, giving us outlets to feed our desires in or out of context. It doesn't matter the context. What matters is you deserve to be happy. One thing is sure, you have cravings and you should meet those cravings. You should be happy. You deserve to be happy. And happiness, well, that just means meeting your cravings. Whatever your cravings and your desires are, just meet them. You have an appetite, fulfill it. So on one side, you've got religion saying no desire. And on the other, you have the non-religion saying no, whatever you desire. Do whatever you have to do to feel better. Just be happy. Get comfy. It's like one plays off the other. And if you pay attention to the culture, you'll see this. I mean, if you walk down the aisle and look at the adjectives that are used to sell chocolate, like sinful and decadent, you know, like you were never meant to taste that. It's like one side says desire is Satan and must be completely avoided. The other side says desire is God and it must be served. It's your master. Both sides completely missing the issue. And I think they miss the issue because they haven't looked at the issue deeply enough. C.S. Lewis, he's this author, and he writes a book entitled The Weight of Glory. And in it, he says this. He says, indeed, if we consider the unblushing promises of reward and the staggering nature of the rewards promised in the Gospels, it would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at sea. We are far too easily pleased. We are far too easily pleased. It's not that our desires are too strong. It's that they're too weak. They're too shallow. We enthusiastically settle for something that seems like it's going to make everything better. I worked for a sales company years ago, and we'd have these quarterly meetings where we get together with local branches, and then the bigger meetings once a year with the division. But every 4 years, we have this worldwide conference. And one particular year, we met at the Grand Ole Opry with thousands of each other from around the world. It's this big four-day international suits and ties, keep up the good work, charts and graphs, arrows pointing up and to the left. It's all about the little man, work harder and smarter, and here's a list of totally unrealistic expectations to send you home with kind of thing. I mean, every one of us have been to one of these meetings, it seems like. So we're there, and every day it's workshops and note-taking, and we're wearing ties, but we never leave the building. And every night there's some rags-to-riches motivational speaker and whatever. So all through the week, they keep thanking us for our hard work and for taking time out of, we could be selling, but we've taken time to be equipped, and they're thanking us, and they keep saying, at the end of this week, we're going to deliver the goods. We are going to have some entertainment. We promise to deliver you something that'll be worth your time. So, I mean, we speculated what that entertainment could possibly be at a sales meeting, you know? A magician, a comedian, maybe a musician, maybe a combination. Well, I mean, whatever it was, it would be second rate, you know? It would be inexpensive. So the last night finally comes, and we're exhausted, and we want to go home, but we're curious what the entertainment was actually going to be, and we're sitting that final night in the round table, and I got my notebook and my loosened tie, and they give the final thanks, and we're all just kind of like, whatever. And they say, thanks again for your dedication and your hard work this week. Now, as promised, we said we'd deliver. We have some entertainment for you tonight, and we hope you enjoy it. Introducing international recording artist, Foreigner. The whole place kind of looks at each other and says, like, Foreigner, like the 70s, 80s band? I mean, everybody in one moment went completely nuts. Me and the guys at the table, we're a good 100 feet from the stage, and everybody in this room, huge room at the Grand Ole Opry, we just rush the stage. And so people, it's just chaos, and people are running, and they go all the way to the stage with me in the front of this wave, and I've got my elbows on the stage, and there they are playing, and they're screaming, and and I realize something. I don't like Foreigner. I know some of their songs by the chorus because I grew up with people that had an 8-track and a mullet. So I'm aware of their music. But I truly do not like Foreigner. I just busted my tail to be in the front of this wave, to get to this stage. I just worked hard for something I don't really even like. I enthusiastically settled for something I knew I didn't want or like. I put energy into something that had nothing to do with who I am. Now, I'm not saying that if you listen to Foreigner that you forfeit your birthright. I'm sure it's fine if you've got a couple of those old 8-tracks. What I'm saying is this. It's possible in a moment to feel what you think is a deep desire for something or someone, for some kind of experience, some kind of craving, some kind of urge that you have, to feel like in that moment that there's nothing more in the world that's as important as this. It's possible to feel that way when in reality you don't want that thing at all. It's possible. And you do it over and over and over. And there comes a moment when you look back on your life and you're going to be forced to ask the question, when I look at my life, my moments, do I see God's purposes at work? Or will I see a frustrated, enthusiastic pursuit of shallow pleasure and things that never, ever delivered what they promised? Oh, we work hard. We claw our way to the top, to the front, for things that seem able to make life feel better on some superficial level. But we've settled. And you know you've settled because afterward, every time you give into this urge, this craving, this lust, this desire, when you let it reign over you, when you let it master you, every time on the other side of it, you look and you realize, once again, it was empty. It didn't deliver what it promised it would deliver. Look at the rest of the passage in Genesis 25. It's really brilliant in how simple it is. It says after the transaction, then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. The red stuff turned out to be lentil stew, beans. And he ate and he drank and then he got up and left. So Esau despised his birthright. That red stuff was going to make everything better. Nothing else mattered in that moment. And it turned out to be lentils. He enthusiastically settled in that moment. He forfeited it all. It was beans. And he ate and he drank and he left. And that was it. He traded everything he could have been for a momentary craving. Lusts and appetites never deliver what they promise. It seems so right. There's nothing you want more. It'll make this moment better. It perhaps has the ability to make my whole life better, it seems. I must give in to this impulse. And so, she wakes up and rolls over early one morning and looks at a guy and she's not sure if he gave his real name after having had sex with him. And thinks, lentils. It's 1 a.m. and he's logged onto the internet again when everybody else is asleep. And he's starting to have this intense feeling and he's starting to fantasize and consider things he's never considered before. And it feels like he's getting ready to go over the edge. And maybe he has before, but he said never again. And his head gets so cloudy and he's never been more alone. It's lentils. He walks out into the garage and he looks at this thing and says, it depreciated $10,000 while I slept. I just financed lentils. I'm still not going to be admired. She puts a brand new pair of shoes in the closet. The last 8 pair, they didn't come through, but this pair. These are the ones. These are going to make me a better woman. She had to have them. And she looks and says, what am I thinking? Lentils. He eats the whole pan. It was the family size. And he gets done, and he's hungrier than ever. It was lentils. She drinks the whole bottle. Everybody else was doing it. That was the connection piece. I don't know these people, but man, we had that together. And I drank the whole bottle. And she wakes up. It was lentils. And she says, I'll never do it again. But then a week goes by. Over and over and over. With energy and commitment and an amazing ability to justify how we're going to soothe the craving, we enthusiastically and passionately settle for things that have nothing to do with our destiny. It's just beans every time. It looks like I gotta have it. I have to have that thing. I have to experience that. I have to feel that. I have to taste that. I have to do that. And you're done, and it's like, I feel worse. I feel worse. And apparently, feeling badly about it isn't part of the solution. It's part of the problem. That's something else that I've got to cover. Another longing to drive a craving. And another week goes by, and the diet it didn't take. Another week goes by, and she still refuses to eat. Another week goes by, and the website, that's still a favorite. Another week goes by, and the addiction is still master. And that's the cycle of feeling badly and resolving not to do it again, and then believing once again that this time the lust will deliver. Thousands of years after the Esau and Jacob incident, the writer of the book of Hebrews makes some comments on it in chapter 12, verse 16. Says this, see that no one is sexually immoral or is godless like Esau. Those two things just got compared if you didn't catch that. Or is godless like Esau, who for a single meal sold his inheritance rights as the oldest son. Afterward, as you know, he wanted to inherit this blessing. He was rejected. He could bring about no change of mind. Please let me have my birthright back. He sought the blessing with tears. No. Esau is referred to here as godless. He's referred to here as being this creature that acts on superficial impulses, that moves like an animal from urge to urge, that lived as though a human being is nothing more than a collection of appetites. And so life is nothing more than satisfying those appetites. And he's called godless. And one day he decided, probably impulsively, you know, I want my birthright back. I want it back. He really felt it. He cried that day, but he was rejected. It was like he was being told, no. Your destiny is not just one more impulsive thing. Esau, you're going to change your mind again tomorrow. You don't know who you are. No. Your destiny is not something that you use impulsively to soothe discomfort. Your birthright is not the flavor of the day. Our lives are so incredibly important that this Bible opens up on the first page by saying, you're made in the image of God. Nothing else created gets spoken of that way. You're made in the image of God. Christian writers writing to the first Christians who were Jews who grew up worshiping and celebrating God in a sacred temple made of stone. They told them, you know what? No. God has taken it a little bit further. Now you are the temple. I mean, the first Jews were like, huh? No, you are the temple. You are so important that God's Spirit has taken up residence in your heart. You all, collectively and individually, house God. But we get so caught up in a culture that celebrates superficial longings, that puts beans on the altar and laughs at birthright and destiny talk. We get so caught up in that that we repeatedly and energetically settle. We get so used to it, we just settle. And we commit the sin of Esau when the way that we live and think and behave, what we say, it's done so in such a way that it's like there is no higher plane. It doesn't matter. God says I'm immeasurably important, but that doesn't matter. What matters is I need to get comfortable. I need to be happy. I'm nothing more than cravings. We sin when we say, you know, I can do whatever I want. Whatever I take in, physically or intellectually, or whatever I put out, it does not matter. What matters is what I want in any given moment. That's the sin of Esau. What I put in my body, what I put in my mind, the way I spend my energy, the way I treat people when my own comfort or my own interests are at stake, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. But see, in reality, my thoughts and my actions and my words, they're all a reflection of whether or not I get it. Do I get that I'm more? Do I get that as a human being, I'm more and I'm loved? Will I look back on my life and see God's purposes played out? Or am I going to look at my life as the summation of soothed cravings, moving like an animal from urge to urge to urge? The Bible has this repeated, desperate cry of God saying, you are more. Don't settle. You are more. Don't settle. You are not a collection of appetites. You are more than the summation of lust. You are more. Don't settle. Don't settle. Day to day, week to week, month to month, moment to moment, night to night, meal to meal, drink to drink, conversation to conversation, decision to decision. Don't settle. You are more. I made you. You are more. Don't lose sight of that. I'm going to read from Colossians in the New Testament, chapter 3, as we close. Paul says some very interesting things to the first Christians. Chapter 3 in Colossians, verse 3. For you died, and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. It's like he said, for the old you died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature, like your animal nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, not desires, evil desires, greed, which is idolatry. Because of these, the wrath, the anger of God is coming. You used to walk in these ways in the life that you once lived, but now you must rid yourselves of all such things as these: anger and rage and malice and slander and filthy language from your lips. Don't lie to each other, and don't live a lie. Since you have taken off your old self with its practices and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator. That's not you anymore. You're more. You're more. Don't settle. You are more. Do not ever settle. You look at her face and her body. She's not something to use for your cravings. She's a child of God, and so are you. You both have a destiny. She's not a product to be consumed. You both have a destiny. You're both loved. You look at this meal as like, you know what, at least this I can get some satisfaction out of. It's not your master. Eating it or refusing to eat it for unhealthy reasons, that's, you're loved. Your master loves you. Your cravings, that's not your master. Something that is being abused in your life, something that you've grown cloudy over in your life, that is not your master. Your master, God, loves you. And He wants you to know that you're not an animal. You're not a collection of cravings. Life is more than satisfied urges. You are more. And so, to follow Jesus doesn't just mean putting your faith in Him. It means accepting the faith that He has in you. Your Father, it tells you, let me help you. You can do this because you're more. You are more. Don't commit the sin of Esau and live from impulse to impulse. You are more. Don't settle. I gave you a destiny. Don't settle. Father, it would be naive to think that half an hour of words is going to change everything. God, will you use this moment like a very bright light for us to recognize all the ways that our appetites dictate too much of our life. God, help us not to think, okay, the idea is to get rid of desire, or that the idea is to completely give up, or that the idea is to turn up the volume somehow on our willpower. God, we all know that our willpower comes and goes. May we moment to moment know that we're loved, and that in that love you have given us a destiny. God, may today be a step for people. Whatever that looks like, may it be a step. We want to live the life that you've given us. We don't want to live according to the cover of a magazine. We don't want to live according to what anyone has ever told us about happiness. We want the joy that comes from knowing you and the birthright we each get to enjoy. You may find yourself, it feels like there's this light on an issue, and you're like, okay, I don't know what step to take. I don't know what to do. And so, one of the things that we talk a lot about around here is that you need desperately to be doing life with people. And so we talk about groups here a lot because we feel like that's the best thing that we can offer you, is these groups of people to do life with. We just had the Merge event last Sunday, had over 100 people find a group, and there's still some opportunities to get into a group. You have to have people running alongside of you to remind you that you're more. People that, when you get caught up in an impulse or something, that they love you enough to say, what are you doing? You're better than that. People that you begin to trust so much that when they say that, it doesn't feel like judgment or condemnation. It's like, oh, that hurt good. Thank you. We have to have people like that around us. If you don't have those people, this problem is not going to get better. Something else that Jonathan even mentioned last Sunday is many of you, you've got to speak to a professional about this. I mean, we all need counseling. Some people say, well, you know, counseling, that's one of those new age. Jesus said, I'm going to leave you the Holy Spirit. You know what He called Him? A counselor. It's like He said, you all need to be on a leather couch, man. We all have to have people who are gifted to listen and help us frame things in our life. And some of you need help finding out, why do I keep eating? What drives that craving? Or why have I refused to eat? What am I trying to do? What drives that? Why do I keep drinking like that? Why am I using drugs? What is this obsession I have with the opposite sex images, pornography, fantasies? What drives that? You need to talk to somebody about things like that. And finally, but certainly not least, you can't do this without your Creator. Aside from religious talk, you just can't. Because every one of you, every one of us, has traded our birthright for a bowl of something. And God sent His Son, you could say His firstborn Son, His one and only Son, and said, I'll trade you my birthright if you'll give me your bowl. We would love to have that conversation with you, to find out what it means to let God take up residence in the most holy of all temples, you, and to make that trade, to have His birthright and trade for the thing you traded yours for. That's maybe an email this week, maybe a conversation. We'd love, love, love to have that conversation with you. So go out into this week and be a people that recognizes that desire in its context is a good, healthy thing, but it is never God. God is your Creator, and He loves you, and He's given you a birthright. Don't settle. God bless you.